This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Heart Greens. Helping to support healthy blood pressure and circulation just became hassle-free. Introducing Heart Greens, the functional food that you drink using the same dark leafy greens recommended by both the DASH and Mediterranean diets. Get a free canister of Heart Greens with your first order and a 100% money-back guarantee. Heart Greens even guarantees you'll love the taste. Call 800-951-8940. That's 800-951-8940. Or visit IntelligentGreens.com. That's IntelligentGreens.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to do a deep dive on a subject which I find fascinating and which we've talked a little bit about, but I want to expose it to our audience in greater depth, and that is genetic testing and its potential to tell us about our eating habits, our behaviors, our aptitudes in terms of exercise, even our nutritional requirements, and perhaps pointing in the direction of what is the optimal diet. That's called nutrigenomics. And today we're going to talk to the author of a great book. She's Dr. Jennifer Stagg. Dr. Stagg is a naturopathic physician. She started out as a doctoral student in biochemistry, and that comes through in her book, which is very comprehensive and detailed and explained stuff in a user-friendly way. She then graduated with a doctorate in naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. And she's currently a naturopathic physician and owner of the integrative specialty practice Whole Health Associates in Connecticut. She's been throughout the media. She's appeared on NBC, ABC, CBS, and she also teaches other physicians. And she's written a book with a provocative title, Unzip Your Genes. Okay. Five choices to reveal a radically radiant you. Dr. Stagg, congratulations on a very enticing title, Unzip Your Genes. You know, you'd think that this might be in the romance section of the bookstore, right? You know, it kind of grabs you.
Yes, exactly.
Is it a steamy book? Is it steamy?
It is anything but steamy.
Okay. Well, look.
Obviously, we're trying to attract some attention so people would actually pick up that book because genetics doesn't always get people excited.
Okay. So, but I'm fired up about this. I mean, that got me on the hook for sure. And of course, genes, it's a play on word. It's spelled G-E-N-E-S, as in genetics and heredity. And so what do you mean by unzip your genes? Is there really such a thing as unzipping genes? Is that what scientists do sometimes in the biochemistry lab? Can they cleave genes?
Yeah, they can, but that's not what I'm referring to here. I'm more the concept of helping to understand your unique biochemistry by taking a look a little bit more closely by doing genetic testing and understanding how your DNA has such a strong impact on your health status.
Okay, so you say in the book very, very clearly, your genes are not your destiny, because if that were the case, that would lead us to a certain fatalism. You know, you might have a psychopathic gene, you know, or a murderer's gene, or a gene which makes it impossible for you to optimize your weight, the so-called fat gene. Should we succumb to fatalism because of genetic testing?
No, absolutely not. So, I mean, that was kind of the old school thinking. And now, you know, in the last 20, 30 plus years, we've had a much better understanding that the way our genes are expressed are highly influenced by our environmental exposures and that intimate relationship that we experience daily with all of our daily habits, from everything, you know, to what we eat, how we exercise, how we deal and manage with stress. All of those components are having an effect on how your genetics actually ends up manifesting into health status.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, and you may have caught this because there was an article that really grabbed me a few weeks ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, no less, which looks, it was a very comprehensive study of people who have an array of genes that put them at risk for cardiovascular disease. I think they looked at, you know, dozens of genes and they put it together in some kind of analysis and they said, okay, these people may have roughly double the risk for heart disease of normal people because of their genes. Nothing to do with cholesterol.
Yeah.
But what they found was that if they adopted some simple lifestyle habits, and it wasn't very ambitious. It was like exercise one day a week, eat a, you know, kind of a Mediterranean diet, don't smoke, and maintain optimal weight, that they can almost reduce their risk to that of the average person. So that suggests that there is some escape clause from your genetic destiny.
Right. And so that's the focus of this book, is that you do have the ability to take actions that would affect your overall health. And so what we do know about genetic testing, a couple of key points is that when people, there were a couple of European studies showing that when people had wellness genetic testing and found out that they had the obesity gene, for example, they ended up with better health outcomes because they start to take care of themselves better.
And
so
that's
simple lifestyle habits that they can adopt can make a profound impact on their health.
And that's a good thing because, you know, one might ask the question, is all this genetic testing worthwhile? Could it, in effect, demotivate people, make people, you know, say, depressed and say, my genes made me do it?
Yeah, so I had that approach and questioned that when I first started looking at the option of adding genetic testing into the services of how I assess patients. And so when I started to dig and found some of these studies about it, the actual testing process, improving health outcomes, first of all, I was very intrigued by that. And then understanding some of the more specifics on dietary management, for example, how when you go on a genetic matching diet, which is what's capable now in terms of genetic testing, that it can result in 2.5 times the weight loss of someone not on their genetic matching diet. So that immediately grabbed my attention because we deal with this issue with weight management, you know, in the bulk of our patients.
You know, of course, this is a science which is in its relative infancy. So if we were to compare it with maybe, you know, like the cell phone era, I think maybe we could compare it to the time when we had those big, you know, bulky cell phones that, you know, you'd hold to your ear and they look like bricks. You know, as opposed to the modern era where we have these refined devices that not only are cell phones, but are, you know, can guide every aspect of our lives, and they, you put them in your hip pocket. But do you think that the testing is ready for prime time? That's controversial.
So to a degree. So some of this research, obviously, some of these genetic variants that we have the capability to test, have been the subject of many studies, and some of them have not. So I think compiling a profile of genomics that actually has enough data behind it that provides actionable course for a patient is where we need to be right now. And I think that exists for sure at this point, but every month there are new SNPs that are being, that reports are being published on, papers are being published on, that you can expect that you could probably continue to do genetic testing, you know, even on a yearly basis and find out new pieces of data to add to your, sort of your book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, let's get down to basics. What is a SNP?
Yep. So a SNP, is an acronym for a mouthful of scientific terms. So it's a single nucleotide polymorphism. So what that means is there's just a single change in a string of DNA, and it's usually the SNPs typically aren't within genes, they're in between, and some of them have more important impacts on our health than others. These are not the kind of mutations that you would think about when someone goes and has genetic testing in the setting of dealing with, like, chromosomal abnormalities, you know, for patients who are undergoing genetic counseling related to fertility or repeated miscarriages.
So it's not like a cystic fibrosis gene or something that could have devastating consequences.
Exactly. So we're not talking about those. So these SNPs are most people, the more common SNP people have heard of would be the MTHFR SNP. So a lot of people are more literate about that, and I'll even have patients that come into my practice having had that testing and then not knowing what to do about it. But this is the same sort of concept, but in the realm of wellness genomics.
Right. So MTHFR, let's see if I can get this right, methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. I think I almost got it.
Right. Yep.
So MTHFR, and this is a family show, so let's keep it clean. It's a shorthand for a gene that does a lot in the body. I think some people think of these things like mutations, like there is such a thing as a perfect human. And then there are these mutations. People are mutants. They have something faulty. These are not necessarily faulty things. They're just variations on the theme.
So they're more what we call variations. So the term mutation will be used to try to help people understand it better. But really it is. It's exactly what you said. It's a variation. And in my book, I talk a lot about referring about these to patients of what makes you unique. This is why I have a set of behaviors that are different from yours, or, how I respond to food will be different than how someone else responds to food.
So MTHFR has something to do with a process called methylation. So what are the consequences of these variations in MTHFR?
Yeah, so there are a number of those MTHFR SNPs. And when we look at basic genetics, you can have one or two copies, meaning that you got one from your father, one from your mother, and depending on if you have multiple copies of these genes, it can impair the enzyme process more so than less copies of those SNPs. So there's very quite a bit of variation among how much it will impact a patient. So we'll see people who have just one copy of one of the SNPs for MTHFR, and it may not have that big of an impact on their health, versus someone else who has a double copy or homozygous. Mm-hmm. And that could be impacting how they're detoxifying. It can impact their mood because of neurotransmitters. We even see it in patients who have PCOS. I'll commonly see some variants in the MTHFR being part of what's at play in those patients. But then there's the issue of, how much of an impact is it really having? So in some cases, it gets more complex that there are other methylation SNPs layered on top of that. And so that could obviously complicate matters, but then there's the general health status of, how a person is handling stress, mm-hmm. and what they're eating that impacts that as well.
Or if they're hit with a lot of mercury, or if they're hit with other types of environmental toxins
that might
challenge their system and put them over the edge in terms of disease pathology.
Yes.
All right. So, speaking of MTHFR, say someone has a variation on that. Is there a standard way to address that, or is it kind of like tough luck?
Yeah, no. I mean, so for that one, what we're talking about is the impairment in the ability. So it's more difficult to activate folic acid. So most people know about folic acid, that women should take it to have a healthy pregnancy, to prevent neural tube defects. And so that's kind of the general kind of introduction to folic acid most people have had, that it's important for pregnant women or women of childbearing age. And so then we're talking about folic acid. In this instance, what happens is that when we consume folic acid, it needs to be activated or methylated. And so that's the process that should happen in your body. And if it's impaired or if that process is not working well, the solution is you can take folic acid that's already activated. So you take a supplement that has methylated folate in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we start patients out typically on a lower dose of that methylfolate because people can potentially have problems tolerating much higher levels of methylfolate.
Mm-hmm. And that has something to do with yet another gene. It gets complicated. It's the COMT gene, which if that's
right.
messed up, then you can kind of go into overdrive when you take too much in the way of B vitamins.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's also an art to all of this. There's a science, and then there's an art, and this is where I often refer to the science being a little bit of ahead of the clinical practice. Like, we have these tools that are available to us, but in terms of, you know, our ability to utilize them in clinical practice, it is at this point a little bit of an art.
Okay, well, let's not dwell too much on MTHFR because we're going to do an entire program on that subject with Dr. Kara Fitzgerald in a little while. I think you're probably familiar with her.
Right.
She's
yeah.
An MTHFR maven, so we'll do a real deep dive on that in a few weeks. Okay, so let's look at some practical implications of the genetic testing. And I'm familiar with the genetic testing you talk about in your book, because we've done it at the Hoffman Center. And it actually sheds light on food behaviors. And you have a very nice chapter on that because, you know, some people feel impelled to overeat. They're at the mercy of their food cravings. And maybe, just maybe, it's not a moral failing. Maybe they've got some genetic predisposition to that. So explain.
Sure. So that's the first section that when I review a session, what we call genetic counseling, when we initially go over the results of their testing, the first place I start is with the series of behavioral SNPs that are related to your relationship with food. And so there are six of those that we actually test for. And this is always enlightening to me because many of the patients that end up doing this testing have had struggles with their weight for years, and they've, you know, had problems with eating behaviors. So when they start to see some of these SNPs that show up for them, it starts to make sense. And it also is a bit of a relief, is what I end up seeing. So patients, for example, one of the common ones I see is something called eating disinhibition. And what that means is there's a gene that essentially wires you to be an emotional eater. So even in a stressful situation or a happy situation, like a party and there's a buffet, you would potentially have a problem stopping eating the foods that you like.
Once you stop, you can't start.
I say, does that, yeah.
You lack the brakes. You've got an accelerator, but you got a weak brake drum. Okay.
Yeah, can't stop, and so that's a big issue, because then you're going to eat too many calories, and that will obviously contribute to weight problems. And then we see issues with satiety. So when I start to see 3-4 of these together, we know we're dealing with some strong kind of wired tendencies. And so we're able to then specifically target those. Like, we wouldn't then, put a patient on a plan where they could just, you know, eat unlimited amounts of food. So then we're talking about portion control. We're talking about keeping some of those foods just, like, out of the house completely. Because, you know, some people are going to have trouble with that.
You have to sort of take a zero-tolerance approach if you have this gene, because otherwise, you're on a seafood diet. You see it. You eat it.
That's true. And so then there's a gene for a SNP related to satiety. So then people will have trouble just feeling full, and so they're always hungry. There's one for snacking. So you start to couple these together, and, you know, you have trouble, you know, stopping eating. You have trouble with snacking. You have trouble with never feeling full. It starts to make a lot of sense to people. And I've seen some of my patients crying when they start to learn this, because the relief, the guilt that especially women associate with their eating behaviors now is sort of validated that it's not just them, it's how they are wired. That alone is kind of enlightening to them and freeing. But then we can start to work on, you know, these targeted behaviors.
There seems to be a gene specifically for sweet tooth. What does that entail?
Yeah, so this is, I wrote a blog about this a couple of years ago, and it, essentially you can be wired to like sweet as well. So we know that sugar is just addictive on its own. So I'll see patients who don't have this kind of sweet tooth SNP, and they're just addicted to sugar because of exposure, because it's very addictive. But then I will have patients who have this sweet tooth, and they're just kind of primed to go for sweet.
Does that have to do with a sweet taster gene? Because it might seem counterintuitive, but someone who doesn't have a strong response to sweets might require more sweets to generate a reward. Is that possible?
Yep, that's correct. So they can have a decreased taste for sweets, so they just don't taste the food as being that sweet. And some of those studies have also been done in Native American populations, a specific population of Pimas, and they've had some difficulty with this particular variant.
Maybe because from an evolutionary standpoint, they've generated a tremendous drive in starvation mode to go for sources of sweet calories, which they, in a natural environment, are very rare.
Right.
But then, you know, when exposed to a Western environment, they're plentiful. You just go down to the 7-Eleven and, you know, knock yourself out.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And then there are bitter tasters. And, of course, that actually may reflect on, you know, some like fussy kids who, you know, don't eat their veggies and greens, and, you know, sometimes people who eat kind of a lot of refined foods because they hate veggies. They just hate veggies.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like they're contrarians.
I honestly didn't understand that a few years back, that we would, you know, go over a healthy eating plan for patients, and they would say, I don't like this, I don't like that, I can't eat that. And, you know, when you on your own are eating those foods and don't see any problem with it, sometimes there's a disconnect that it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then understanding that there's this whole taste, bitter taster. So what's happening is you're just tasting, have a stronger taste for those bitter pigments that are in these healthy foods, like leafy greens. And they will come out more so in cooked vegetables. So we'll also see it in kids. So then some of the solutions around that to get people to eat those foods would involve, like, eating raw vegetables for one thing, because the bitterness isn't brought out when the food is raw. But also techniques like roasting broccoli and cauliflower can mask some of the bitter taste. And so this is a way of getting those healthy compounds that actually affect your DNA and help your genes get expressed in a healthy pattern. Allow people to eat it and have more of a tolerance level for those foods.
Mm-hmm. Your genes can also tell you whether you're more or less likely to be hyper-responsive to caffeine, or whether you are able to tolerate a lot of alcohol, or whether you're able to tolerate lactose from dairy.
Yes, yep. And so we found, even in some of this testing, a lot of people, when we talk about caffeine, some people, majority I would say, know if they have a problem with caffeine, that, you know, if they drink it after noon or certainly by dinner time, that they could have problems sleeping, or if they drink too many cups, they could feel jittery. But I will still come across patients who have been drinking quite a bit of coffee, and they are sleeping okay, and they are seemingly fine. And when we find this information that they are not processing caffeine, so they're not detoxifying the caffeine as quickly, they're actually at a higher risk of having a heart attack. So there's a study on this particular SNP, and drinking more than 4 cups of coffee will significantly raise the risk of having a heart attack. So we definitely then are recommending them go down to no more than 1 cup, standard cup of coffee daily.
Interesting. And then there are the people who can, you know, have a hollow leg, they can drink under the table. And the people who, you know, have some kind of genetic glitch where, you know, they're what you call a cheap date, you know, one cocktail
and
they're...
We see that. That particular SNP is more so in patients who have Asian ancestry. Mm-hmm. So this is where people can have a problem, like they get nauseous, they're getting flushed when they drink alcohol, just small amounts, because they just can't process it. So they can't detoxify the alcohol. They have a deficiency in the enzyme that processes alcohol, but they can get even violently ill from it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you can. And most people, by the time they reach adulthood, can tell you if they're intolerant to lactose. But maybe, you know, some people come in and they have irritable bowel syndrome and they don't even realize that they're lactose intolerant. It's like,
yeah.
Wow. It's like,
yeah, I did end up having a patient that had the testing done, and he was having, he didn't have the classic GI symptoms of, you know, loose stools or abdominal pain, but he was having intermittent reflux symptoms. And he showed that he had this SNP related to lactose intolerance, and so he cut out dairy on his own as a result of that, and he didn't have heartburn after that.
Hmm. Excellent. All right, yeah. You've laid the groundwork for a continued discussion of what our genes can tell us about our nutritional requirements, about our exercise capacity, whether or not we're prone to obesity. Even what supplements might be advisable, what, you know, is kind of fit in a jigsaw-like pattern into our the puzzle of our genetic makeup. We're going to continue with our discussion of today's book, Unzip Your Genes, Five Choices to Reveal a Radically Radiant You, with our guest, Dr. Jennifer Stagg. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.